That music was called Saturday Night at the Firehouse by American composer Henry Cowell, written in 1948. For anybody who happens to know his name, you would probably have been surprised to know that that music was by him, because he made his, if not his reputation, at least he's best known by music students anyway, musicologists, composers, for his more avant-garde music. That's what they write about in the music history books anyway. Not that kind of piece. That is what I would call musical nostalgia, both in the name and the sound of it. And that is music that will begin a concert this Friday night by the Prairie Ensemble at Faith United Methodist Church on South Prospect Avenue in Champaign, concert at 7:30. And this is Live and Local. I'm Kevin Kelly. This is one of those days where I actually wear two hats, because I happen to conduct the Prairie Ensemble. We do 3-4 concerts a year, and this is one of those weeks. And so I'm not exactly going to interview myself, but I'll sort of be in the role of talking about portions of the concert, but also get to have my usual role here as interviewer, because I have with me on the program today both of the soloists who will be joining us on that particular concert. It's an all-American program called America's Music, and that title has a couple of different meanings. One, it simply means it's a concert of American music, but also makes specific reference to jazz as among America's musics. Different people, different types of musicians, I think, vie for that notion. Blues musicians would say, hey, that's America's music, and certain kinds of old-time music and so on, but I don't think anybody disputes that jazz was born in the United States of America. My guests are, as some call them, the two Chips, Chip McNeil, who is head of the jazz division at the University of Illinois School of Music, and also tenor sax player, who will be joining us on the program. We'll be playing some of his arrangements as well. And Chip Stevens, who is one of two jazz pianists on faculty, and will be joining us as part of the orchestra. Both of them are joining us for part of the orchestra to play on each other's pieces. Chip Stevens joining the orchestra to play on Chip McNeil's arrangements. Chip McNeil joining the orchestra to play Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue, which mm-hmm. Chip Stevens is going to be featured on as soloist. So, first, thanks to both of you for your willingness to participate in this concert and for joining us on the radio show today.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Very much so. Thanks, Kevin, for having us.
I mean, usually I get to talk to you about jazz gigs that you all are doing, mm-hmm. Which are straight-ahead jazz. And this one is kind of yes in the case of your arrangements, Chip McNeil, mm-hmm. and kind of yes in Rhapsody in Blue, Chip Stevens, partly because the concerto, Rhapsody in Blue, is kind of a jazz piece,
mm-hmm.
but also kind of yes because you're going to be doing some things either with it or to it, depending upon one's point of view.
Yes, that have never been done.
That have never been done.
World premiere.
That's true. It'll be kind of the world premiere of this version of Rhapsody in mm-hmm. Blue, although most of it will be really quite familiar to everybody. Where to start in this discussion? Well, I'm kind of curious about whether either of you have any kind of a classical music background, or have you been purely jazz trained? Whoever opens his mouth
question.
First.
Well, you know, I think both Chip and I went to school.
I'm glad started to know school. You went to school.
Yeah. But what I was going to say is that we went to school at a time when there wasn't that many programs in the country that had jazz programs.
Right.
The University of North Texas, what was then called North Texas State.
Mm-hmm. Sure was.
The University of Miami. Was there anything else?
Oh, I think Cal State Long Beach had one, and maybe one or two in New York, but very
right.
few.
There was very few. Yeah. And so if you wanted to go to school, I had to get a classical piano degree, and both of my degrees are in classical piano.
Hmm.
But the thing that I learned pretty quick, I mean, I always made my living playing jazz piano. I feel very grateful that I studied classical piano, because it, you know, really exposes you to the breadth of pianistic sounds that are available to you that if you just play jazz, you may not get. Mm-hmm. Learning how to read, you know, there's a lot of jazz pianists, although that's changed a lot in the last, I don't know, 20 years or so. But I mean, there was a period of time when guys, they didn't read well at all. And you could make a living being that way. Mm-hmm. But now, I mean, the industry has changed to the point that you got to show up and read because they don't have the money to pay people for a week or two of rehearsals.
To learn music by rote.
Exactly.
That's right.
Or by
That's
example, right. which is like the same thing.
So, yeah. What about mm-hmm. you, Doctor?
Well, similar. Same thing. I mean, I definitely started. Actually, I started as a classical pianist as well. I still play the piano quite often and do a jazz gig occasionally. I mean, albeit not anywhere near Chip's level, but I still enjoy playing. And I got into playing the saxophone via the piano, which I think almost every great musician I know, whatever their genre, has some type of piano background. Mm-hmm. The piano is just harmonically, and especially in American music and jazz and the American songbook, anything like that, Gershwin, any of the Tin Pan Alley composers and arrangers, the piano is so important because it's the only picture of harmony that we have. It's the only instrument that really gives you a way to literally visualize some of the things that you're playing. And as a horn player, I can say that's probably one of the smartest things I ever did was to continue to play the piano and not stop. Mm-hmm. And I started with the real traditional, I'm sure like Chip, you know, classical literature when I was young. And I played pretty seriously classically up till probably I was 13 or 14. And I started maybe when I was 5 or 6. And I still like to play. It's just like Chip said, it exposes you to the breadth of a lot of different kinds of music just because it's an instrument that's been around for so long and there's so much literature for it in all mm-hmm. kinds of genres. And I learned how to read music via the piano. So you're learning two clefs and to use both your hands so that when I transfer to the saxophone, it's a lot easier to read, you know, mm-hmm. a lot easier to learn how to read coming from the piano.
It's one of the few instruments that you can play a self-contained piece on.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
I mean, you can do it in other things. You can do it on
right.
guitar and,
right.
and so on. But it's difficult to do on the tenor sax, for example.
Right.
Or just about any wind instrument or
any single line instrument yeah. because you all of a sudden now you're having to cover a lot of functions with only one note basically at a time. Mm-hmm. Where the piano allows you many.
And orchestra at your fingertips.
Right. And harmonies are there, you know, readily available for you. So the piano is so important, and we do it in our program here at U of I. One of the things we insist all of our jazz majors do is take the piano. Mm-hmm. I mean, they have to take a certain amount of classical training just to get familiar with the keyboard and some basics, but in jazz, as part of their jazz degree, they also have to have some conversancy, and we have courses for that. Chip teaches them, and Joan Hickey, our other jazz pianist, she teaches another sequence of courses, and they're all designed to get the non-pianist into the piano if they've never had exposure before. You know, and it's critically important. Of all the classes I think that we offer, that is right up there for me at the top of things that we mm-hmm. do. Because without that, I don't think they can be successful this day and age.
Everything relates back to it.
Yeah.
That's the reality, you yep. know.
Yeah. It's just a critically important instrument, you know.
Sort of a notion of going the other way, and for this particular concert that you guys are going to be playing on, the first half of the concert has classical music, mm-hmm. but the pieces that I picked all sounded to me like they had, if not jazz in them, at least they had some notion of jazz in them or some elements of music that has shown up in jazz. And since the piece that I opened the program with, I think neither of you guys had ever heard before, mm-hmm. I wondered if you were, while we were talking and listening, if you paid enough attention to have been able to say, oh, there's this element that shows up in jazz or that element.
Well, certainly harmonically. I mean, I've had arguments with some jazz musicians that, you know, the sharp nines and the flat nines and the sharp elevenths and the upper altered extensions is a jazz invention. And the reality is you find all of that stuff in classical music. It's in Bach. It's there. It's in Chopin, the quartal harmonies in Debussy. So, just listening to what we heard here while we were waiting to come on the air, the harmony, it's just everywhere. That's where we, you know, as much as jazz is American, the harmony is European. Mm-hmm. It really is. And certainly there's been a lot of sort of advancements and people pushing the envelope. But the harmony has been around for a long time, you know. Mm-hmm. So I heard a lot of that in that piece.
One of the things that I heard a little bit in that piece, and it's certainly really evident in Rhapsody in Blue and really all of Gershwin's music, one of the reasons he got kind of the mantle of a jazz composer laid on him as a Tin Pan Alley Broadway composer was his use of rhythm, the syncopation. Hmm. Syncopation in the music came through a lot of the Tin Pan Alley, early Tin Pan Alley composers, and he was certainly one of the more famous ones. And Rhapsody in Blue is a great example of that. His opera, you know, Porgy and Bess, that piece you were playing, it has examples of rhythms that are more syncopated, and that was really a jazz, well, what jazz brought into the music, and I would say the
Absolutely.
American part of it, you know, yeah. where Chip said, it's true, the harmonies are really all borrowed from Western European tonal music. The rhythmic part of it mm-hmm. is really a hybrid of a lot of things that are kind of a mirror of the country. You know, they're a mirror of the melting pot nature of America. They have rhythms from, you know, the Caribbean, rhythms from Africa, rhythms from here, Native American rhythms. There's all kinds of rhythmic things. And I think both of us just, we kind of innately do it because we were born into this country and into this music, and it was something we heard from a very young age. Just like if you go to the Caribbean or you go to Cuba and you listen to that, those people, you know, when they listen to, if you're, you know, of Cuban descent, you've heard that music all your life. And it's just kind of your natural rhythmic flavor. And I think American jazz has a rhythmic flavor, you know, even though there was syncopation in Western European music, it's different in American jazz. The way they put it together is different.
Well, the concept of swing is the
right.
defining characteristic.
Right.
In American jazz, you know, that sets it apart from everything else.
And it's a rhythmic concept.
Yes, absolutely.
You know.
Swing.
Swing meaning?
The concept of time.
That's the
swing.
Definition you see in the dictionary when you look it up.
that right there?
Exactly.
How do you write that out?
Oh, I could do it.
It would be an aural dictionary.
You know, and it's basically the walking bass pattern and then mm-hmm. the ride pattern on the ride cymbal of the drummer. And I'm kind of reducing it to the bare bones, but that's really it.
Yeah. Triplet subdivisions of
that's
beats.
That's absolutely right.
It's really like a 3-against-2 feel. There's three triplets, and when we play two notes in the space of three notes. It's kind of what's neat about it for me is that rhythmic concept of squeezing notes into a different kind of, you know, a square peg into a round hole rhythmically kind of, which is very natural for us to do. It's also what the blues is about because the blues, in terms of notes, was about finding the notes in between the notes.
The 13th key.
The 13th, exactly. It's finding those extra notes. So we're even doing it melodically in this country along with the rhythmic stuff, and that's really, you know, that swing and right. the blues really go hand in hand. Mm-hmm. So...
Well, speaking of blues and the notion of the swing, this is... obviously not your arrangement, Chick McNeil, of this piece, but this is one of the pieces that is going to show up on Friday night's concert by the Prairie Ensemble in your arrangement. This is the version of this tune that I always hear in my head just because I own this recording. I've heard it so many different times, but it's got all those things you were just describing. And I forget how quickly they come in, but anyway, you'll probably recognize the tune and you'll certainly recognize the singer. And may or may not recognize the pianist.
My mama done told me when I was in knee pants. My mama done told me, son. Yes, woman, sweet talk. Oh, clickety clack, easy going back to blues in the night. The evening breeze start.
So obviously that's Louis Armstrong on the vocal, and Chip Stevens, you nailed the pianist, first guess.
I got lucky.
Oscar Peterson. What? So How did you, why was that your first guess? What was there in your
head? Oh, I know his playing extremely well. I have a great Oscar Peterson story. I was in a country tavern. I think he died in 08, and I wasn't doing anything except talking. I wasn't drinking or anything like that. Thanks for laughing, Kevin. I appreciate it.
I didn't even know you that well. I mean, for all I know, you may never drink.
I was just hanging out in a country tavern, and the owner of the club came up, and he said, why don't you go up to, they have one of those digital, the small little digital jukeboxes, and he said, why don't you go and give me $5? And he said, go up and pick some. And I walked up there, and there was Oscar Peterson. And the owner of the bar, his name is Ralphie, and I said, Ralphie, have you ever heard of Oscar Peterson? He said, no, but go ahead and play it. So I put the $5 in, and it was Oscar with Ella and the Trumpet Summit and West Side Story. And so I put $5, and they just loved it. And this is a country tavern in the middle of nowhere. The word redneck does stick out to me a little bit. Hip people, though. No. Would never want to seem as though I'm casting an aspersion.
That's right.
And then he gave me another $5, and I played nothing but Oscar Peterson. The next morning in the national news, he died that night. It was unbelievable. Yeah, it was really very touching.
So you were playing his memorial without even knowing.
I didn't even know it. And the next morning, he was in the national news that he had passed away. Yeah, but I know his playing very well. I mean, he's one of the very, very best of voracious pianists. And I saw him live 3 times.
And of course, we heard that, you know, the swinging feel both in the vocal and in the piano and in, you know, a certain element of improvisation in treatment of both of those things.
Sure.
Which is all part of it. We're talking with Chip Stevens and Chip McNeil of the University of Illinois School of Music Jazz Division. Both will be featured on the concert Friday night by the Prairie Ensemble, which I will be conducting. I'm Kevin Kelly, also hosting Live and Local, as always, in that concert Friday night at Faith United Methodist Church in Champaign. Our program today is made possible with support from the Illinois State University School of Music, presenting a Gold Series concert on Thursday, November 15th at 8 p.m. at the ISU Center for the Performing Arts. The Wind Symphony will premiere David Maslanka's new composition for saxophone quartet and wind ensemble.
Wow.
So that'll be on Thursday night.
Saxophones.
Huh?
More saxophones.
More saxophones.
Can never have too many.
Can we handle
it? Yes, you can.
You can have too many.
No, that's not true.
I was going to go somewhere with this conversation. I've immediately forgot. Oh, you know, this is a question that I have just always been dying to ask, but how did you end up getting called Chip, each of you?
Uh-huh.
Oh.
I always wonder about that nickname anyway.
That's not my real name.
Well, John and Charles.
Mm-hmm. Right. My real name is John Cortland Stevens. And my mother loved My Three Sons, that show that used to be on TV, and one of the boys was Chip.
And that was it?
That was it. She thought he was really cute, and so she named me Chip.
And how did your dad feel about that?
He always called me Chip.
I meant about thinking that the kid was cute. Well, I guess if he was young enough, it was okay.
Yeah, he's just a cute kid, a little boy. How about
That's
you?
That's a good story.
Charles, what about you?
I'm trying to think. I don't think anybody ever thought I was cute. No, I'm just kidding. I think my brother maybe, I don't know. You know, Chip is a common.
You must have been asked this before.
Probably.
I've been asked it many times.
Yeah. I mean, I think... I'm trying to think back my earliest memories. I always was called Chip by my folks.
Your dad's not named Charles.
No. Because
sometimes
Robert.
It's Chip off the.
No,
off the block
I think maybe it could have been.
I've heard them all, man.
Yeah, it could have been.
Potato chip.
Yeah, right. What was that one? Potato chip.
Mint chocolate chip.
Well, I always envisioned somebody named Chip, you know, had to be a really preppy sort of character.
Right.
Oh, right.
Mm-hmm. For some, and I don't really know why.
Well, Chipper. Used to be you're really chipper.
Yeah.
This morning. So yeah. Somebody that's kind of up or, you know.
And then when I was teaching at the University of Colorado at Boulder, I had a student call me Buffalo Chip.
Oh, nice. Yeah, that's a whole nother meaning.
But that led to a great name for my combo. I called them Chips Buffaloes.
Nice. And the, there you go.
The provost loved it. He thought it was great, man. Because the you know the name of their football team is
the Buffaloes.
Is the Buffaloes?
Yeah.
Oh, for your school. Did you go? By the way, going back to school and leaving the notion of chips before we get too far into the muck, so to speak. did you both go to North Texas?
No, I did not.
I did though.
But you were like a lot of people that I know over the years. Right. Chip, and I shouldn't speak for you, but Chip went there, but he didn't graduate from there.
Right.
And I know several guys that did a very similar
thing. It was pretty common, actually, back then. Jim Snydero, Tim Reese, Greg Bissonette, a lot of people that are pretty well-known, you know, jazz musicians these days. That was just guys that I went to school with, and none of us graduated from there. Partly the reason, it's an interesting, real quick story. I probably would have come here to go to school because I'm from Illinois originally. And Garvey had the band here at the time.
John Garvey,
yes. But they didn't offer degrees. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly here 30-some years later why I came back was to start the degree programs here at this university in jazz, which is what we've done. Now we offer the master's and the undergraduate and the doctorate, starting them all at the same time. And that's exactly why I didn't stay here. And a lot of people didn't from
why
the state.
Why you didn't stay at North Texas?
Why I didn't come to school
come here
originally.
Right.
Why I ended up going to North Texas. Because I went to North Texas really young when I was 17. I graduated high school in 3 years and I went down there because I was anxious to get going. And I just thought that was one of the few places, like Chip mentioned, you know, that had jazz and it was very well known. And there were a ton of great players there at the time. And then later, I got right to the end and played on a lot of different records and everything. And then I had some friends migrate over to the University of Miami, and I went over to visit them a few times, and I ended up getting asked to go to school there, and they paid for it because it's a private university, and it was really expensive. And anyway, I ended up going over there and graduating from there. And I went on the road for a while, then I came back and got my graduate degree there eventually, too. So I
as well, and
kind of going to both places.
Chip Stevens, you ended up where?
I went to the University of Akron. Well, first I started out at the University of Cincinnati, and things didn't work out really well there. And then I ended up going to the University of Akron, which is where I wanted to go first, because there was a guy, a classical and jazz pianist there named Pat Pace. And Pat became my second father. And it took me 7 years to get my undergraduate degree because I kept going out on the road and playing. And then that degree was in classical piano. And then I got my master's at Cleveland State, and I went there to study with a really well-known classical pianist named Andreas Kuprevicius, and that's where I got my master's.
Well, we're going to talk about the melding of those classical chops with the jazz chops in just a minute here, talking with Chip Stevens and Chip McNeil, who are going to be joining the Prairie Ensemble on their season-opening concert Friday night in Champaign. And I think y'all recognize this music. So you probably recognize, I don't want to be patronizing and assume everybody knows that piece, but I imagine that most listeners to the station have heard Rhapsody in Blue before, which that was the opening of. Actually, this was in fact the opening of the very first performance, or at least very first recording of Rhapsody in Blue. It was in fact a truncated performance for this recording. Not the original performance, with George Gershwin himself at the piano and the Paul Whiteman Orchestra, led by, of course, Paul Whiteman. They are the combination of performers who gave the first concert, a pretty famous concert for various reasons. And it's interesting to listen to Gershwin play that piece and to listen to some of the tempos they took and so on. And the arrangement made, or the orchestration made for that performance, was by a fellow named Ferdy Groffé, who in fact made subsequent, you know, the subsequent famous full orchestra arrangement as well. The full orchestra version is the one that is best known to most listeners. It's this version, which has gotten to be called the jazz band version, that we all will be playing on Friday night with the Prairie Ensemble, and it's a lot of fun to do it. Interesting in that it's a little thinner orchestration, a little more heavy reliance on the winds and brass, tiny number of strings, just a few violins, and that's it. And otherwise, but coming to the question. John Chip Stevens, you know, classical piano versus jazz piano. This piece on its own would probably require mostly technically classical chops.
I don't like necessarily the way you framed it, Kevin. I mean, I think that whether you play the piano, jazz or classical, you need to play it right. And I think saying that, well, classical players have more technique or they play better, that's particularly in this day and age, it's not necessarily true. Don't you agree, Chip?
I totally agree.
I'm not in any way trying to cast an aspersion towards you, my friend, but I think that, you know, it's about being efficient. It's about capturing the breadth of sound that's at your disposal, whatever you play, whether you're a saxophonist, a trumpet, or a pianist. And but I do believe, and it's one of the reasons why we have a classical component in our undergraduate degrees, that there are things that you get exposed to from classical piano that, let's say, just pretend you just play jazz, that you might not get. Being able to show voices on the inside, like, for example, a Bach fugue or something like that. The independence of fingers, the way that you weight them. There's things that you really can get from classical music that you might not, and I'm hesitant to say that you would not get, but I am confident in saying that you probably would not get if you just play jazz. And there are some jazz pianists out there that just don't play well. Whether it's touch, whether it's technique, whether it's fingering, whether it's not having the variety of sound. I mean, there's guys out there that really do beat the hell out of the piano. And there's just a whole other range of expression and emotion at your disposal. And so I'm that's what I mean when I say I don't know, you know, classical chops versus jazz. It's like, look, it boils down to, let's just be efficient. Let's play well. You want to be as fast as you possibly can, but you also want to have, you want to be able to play beautiful. You also want to be able to touch the people in the back of the room, which means play to the bottom of the key bed, but not beat the dickens out of the piano, you know? Does that make sense?
Sure. And then there's also the other element, which will enter into your performance with the Prairie Ensemble Friday, of this piece that couldn't be realized by someone who is just a classical pianist, which is to say you probably, unless you have experience in jazz, couldn't get beyond the notes that Gershwin wrote down.
Right. Therein, I think, lies really the beautiful connection between George Gershwin and jazz. It really affords you the opportunity, you know, if you've got that linear and harmonic freedom as a jazz musician, there's some really cool opportunities in there. And what you and I have done, you as the conductor and me as the pianist, have tried to isolate those sections that I think are really the most famous parts of the melodic content in Rhapsody in Blue. Because you could really, you can kind of go nuts with this thing that we're doing on Friday. And I mean, I'm talking about opening up different sections, because there's a lot of, there's other opportunities that you could really do some things, and the piece would end up being, you know, 30 minutes long.
And when you say open up, that this is a term that I've heard you guys use, meaning you take a section
or
a moment and say, let's just break away from what's written.
That's right.
And
that's right.
Do something else.
But if I can just interject one little thing. Yeah, you're absolutely right. We open up a section, but keep the spirit and the integrity of what Gershwin was going for. Because we have to keep in mind that when this was written in 1923, 1924, bebop hadn't been invented.
Right.
And so it's really cool to just play sort of a period approach But that can be every bit as hip and cool and strong and valuable as pushing the envelope, you know? So that's kind of really been the fun part for me.
Mm-hmm. There's a recording that I had heard and then I shared with you that we have at the station. I might run out and try to get it here. I'm not sure if I will, but I might. With the pianist Marcus Roberts, where he opens up a huge bunch of this piece, and even at one point almost inserts his own composition into the middle of things.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, I've seen that too.
May I offer just, and I would never, you know, Marcus is a marvelous player. Mm-hmm. He really is.
He's been here.
Yes, absolutely.
We had him here.
But I, again, to go back to what I just said a moment ago about capturing the spirit and the integrity of what Gershwin wrote, yet find yourself in it, you know? And I am bold enough to say that I think perhaps they went a little bit far.
Probably, at least in that one section. But one of the things that's interesting, actually, elaborate on that a little bit.
Yes.
And I will be back.
Okay, all right. Well, I think that, you know, he got so far away from it that he didn't play what Gershwin wrote.
Right.
Very little of what Gershwin wrote.
Right.
And you know,
it's almost like recomposing the piece.
Yes,
you know, and there I think you have to be real careful taking license to do that with a piece that's so much a part of Americana.
That's
right. I mean, I agree with you, Chip. It's like when we do, even when we play on the American Songbook and we play a melody. I know you and I are both always telling the students, you know, come back to the melody in your improvisations. Mm-hmm. Reference it. Show that you understand.
That you know it.
That you know it. Yeah, play it first. Let's see that.
Right.
And what can you do? Because don't forget, even the best, the great jazz masters and the early jazz masters, whom those were the people that Gershwin was actually listening to, Fats Waller and some of those people, some of the really great pianists of the day, he listened to the fact that they always understood the melodic content of a piece and that the melody was what held a piece together, not the chord changes and what they
do
improvisationally. You know, it was that melodic content that really holds it together. And I think if you throw that spirit away, now all of a sudden you're just playing on another set of chord changes and it becomes something else. I mean, that's okay. Mm-hmm. In some settings, that's okay. But I think in that setting where you're basing it on a piece and an extended piece for that matter, you know, in this case, I think it's really hard to, I agree, you can get too far away from the original intent.
And I also feel like, Kevin, on did you bring it in? We're going to listen to a little bit
of
it.
It was sitting right next to me here in the studio.
Okay.
But
I think the solos, and I'm being very critical, and perhaps I shouldn't be, but I think that they get a little too contemporary. Because, again, you know, bebop had not been invented when this tune was written. And, you know, what Chip just brought up about melody, we can't ever forget that improvisation started with the melody. I mean, Louis Armstrong started improvising this way. He started messing around with the melody. It wasn't so much about the changes.
No.
That's where it started. That's
just
right.
Just embellishment and the melody.
Well, I wanted to play a little of the opening of Rhapsody in Blue as rendered by the group here, who are the Lincoln Center Jazz Orchestra and members of the Orchestra of St. Luke's combined. Robert, I don't know how to say his last name, Robert Sadin or Sadin. Marcus Roberts is the pianist. But one of the other things that they do and that we're attempting to do as well in our performance is treat some of the lines that Gershwin wrote down and then that Ferdy Groffet arranged and decided this instrument will play it or that instrument will play it, that sound to me as if what he really wrote down was what could have been an improvised line, or at least a line that somebody expressed in a certain way. Gershwin wrote it down. And so that's the way everybody's played it since. What Roberts and his group do is turn some of those back into improvised lines. That's how it sounds to me anyway. Here's some of the opening of, even before we get to the piano. Well, I guess we'll get to the piano part and you'll hear a little bit of what he does. But Marcus Roberts and Company in their rendition of George Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue here on Live and Local. So there you hear kind of a range of what Marcus Roberts and Company do with or to Rhapsody in Blue, depending, as I said earlier, depending on your point of view, with some of those semi-improvised solo licks from various instruments, which may have well have been, you know, Gershwin's idea when he wrote down this stuff. He may have had that in mind, imitating that sense of a jazz performance. And then, of course, you have the written out stuff, and then he begins the solo line exactly as written, and then he breaks away. And Chip Stevens, in our performance, will be doing some occasional bending and, you know, throwing in another chord or two, but in three significant moments, opening things out a lot. Why don't you talk about one of them in particular, because this was kind of an interesting discovery for you as you were learning the piece, the Cuban bit.
Yep. And I think what else was interesting is that when you and I were talking about this last week, Kevin, I shared with you that the way Gershwin wrote it was as a timbal, which is the bass part in the Afro-Cuban rhythm.
And this is the part that you can sing it better than I can. It's this long section just for solo piano.
That's right. It's a very long section. But the thing is, the bass note that Gershwin wrote is on the up of two and on beat four, and that is the timbal pattern. That's what the bass player plays in Afro-Cuban music, and so. One and two, bone, ding, to bone, ding, one and two, and the and four, and one and two, and that's exactly what Gershwin wrote. And I'd been playing it for, I don't know, working on it for about 3 days, and I came down one morning, and I started on that section. That's when I realized this is a timbal, and as far as I know, that's probably the earliest documented or written down, notated version of a timbal. I could be wrong. But I brought that up to you, and then you sat there and you got quiet, and I remember I asked you, I said, what are you thinking about? And you said, well, you know, Gershwin wrote a Cuban overture, I think. Mm-hmm. And then you kind of did some research that night and sent me that really great article about, I forget, the guy's name was Mike that did that article on it, as
Don't
I recall.
Remember,
but anyway, the first thing he said was that it's very little known, yet Gershwin made more money off the Cuban overture than he did off Rhapsody in Blue.
And he did go make a trip to Cuba.
That's absolutely right.
And
that was the other thing that I just was kind of really, but I'd sort of come to this reality well before you had even shared that with me. And I thought that was really cool. So we're going to open that section up and do an Afro-Cuban thing, which I think will be really, really nice and really happening. And again, captures the spirit of that moment in the piece.
And we're talking about a concert Friday night by the Prairie Ensemble, which will be at Faith United Methodist Church in Champaign, featuring Chip Stevens as soloist for Rhapsody in Blue and Chip McNeil in some of his own arrangements of two very well-known standards. We played one of them, Harold Arlen's Blues in the Night, Charlie Chaplin's Smile, although not everybody knows Charlie Chaplin wrote that. I didn't know that.
That's right. He made, speaking of money, Charlie Chaplin made, and the state still continues to make money to this day on that tune.
And he apparently, people who wrote the program notes for me discovered, and you probably knew this, that he wrote the music for all his films. Which I hadn't.
He did a lot of the original. He didn't score it and didn't orchestrate it, but he wrote the themes, which is exactly what he did with this piece. I wanted to bring up, too, with Blues in the Night, people don't realize, too, that's a bit of Americana, since this is kind of an Americana-type concert and full of pieces from Americana. Blues in the Night, and if this piece you might play here in a minute, was written by Harold Arlen, who was another composer that was of the Gershwin era and a Tin Pan Alley composer, and very interested in syncopation and syncopated rhythms, and very interested in in the jazz flavor of the day. Mm-hmm. And as one of his collaborators was the great Johnny Mercer. And Johnny Mercer was also very interested in jazz and very interested in lyrics. And the lyrics to Blues in the Night were written by Johnny Mercer for that tune, to the music of Harold Arlen. And Johnny and him collaborated on many, many a great tune through the years. And Johnny Mercer in his own right was a great composer too, who started out as a film actor and a singer. And so a lot of the lyrics that Johnny Mercer put to tunes, Laura is one of his more favorite ones. Mm. That was an original theme written for a movie with no lyrics. And then Johnny put the words to it much later. So there's a lot of Americana connections in all this music that we're playing on the, yeah, you know, with the Prairie
Well,
ensemble.
Here's this other tune by Harold Arlen.
Yes,
by Leo Robbins.
This is a wonderful tune that almost nobody knows. It's a Harold Arlen tune called "What's Good About Goodbye." And I didn't discover this tune until, I don't know, several years ago, and I'd never heard it. And I thought, what's a beautiful tune. And so I did an arrangement that's got strings on it, and I wrote of these arrangements we're going to play, the Blues in the Night. It has kind of a similar opening. I start the piece with the bridge, and I did kind of a string opening that's a little different than what's in the tune. And this is just kind of an example of some of the string writing they hopefully will come in here on Friday.
One hopes so.
This is a small string orchestra.
As ours will be.
Yes.
As ours
will this be. Very small.
Harold Arlen's music is arranged by Chip McNeil and sung here by Lizanne Lyons. Mm-hmm.
Say goodbye.
That's a song performed by Lizanne Lyons and a number of instrumentalists, but the point of our playing it, aside from the fact that it's music of Harold Arlen, it is an arrangement by Chip McNeil. Three of his arrangements will be on the concert by the Prairie Ensemble Saturday night, which will feature him as both tenor sax and vocal soloist on one of them, anyway. On Friday night at 7:30, there's a pre-concert talk at 7, which I'll be doing actually with these guys. I hope. Didn't ask them. I'm asking you now. Jump on with
sure.
me.
Sure.
What time is it?
Yeah, right.
What time is
the gig?
7 o'clock. And then at 7:30, the concert starts with an all-American, for lack of a better term, classical first half that has a lot of nostalgia and some jazz influence and some other sort of hip sort of things going on. And then the jazz half with Chip, and Chip will be in the second. Well, will be the second half of the program. And I appreciate your joining us both, gentlemen, on the radio.
Yeah, my pleasure too. Thank you for asking us.
Yep.
Well, I think it's going to be a blast, and we're certainly having a lot of fun putting it together. We'll have a little bit more from one of the pieces that will be in the first half of the program in just a moment. I want to mention some other events you can go see and hear live in our listening area over the next couple of days. Let's see, today's Tuesday the 13th. That means that the Jupiter String Quartet is playing at the Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. They're the quartet in residence at the University of Illinois tonight at 7:30. University of Illinois Steel Band playing tonight at 7:30 in competition, also at the Krannert Center. Eastern Illinois University's Jazz Lab Band is playing at the Dowd of Fine Arts Center in Eastern Illinois University in Charleston, 7:30. At Millikan University, or at least in Decatur, two of the Millikan vocal groups, One Voice and Blue Bop, will be at Westminster Presbyterian Church in Decatur. That's tonight, also at 7:30. Making a tour of the universities, it seems, the Illinois State University Opera Practicum final semester performance is at Kemp Recital Hall on the ISU campus in Normal. That's tonight at 7 o'clock. It's Jem and Jimmy Bean and Jeff Arrigo on the Singer-Songwriter Collective in Champaign. That's tonight at Clark Bar in Champaign, 6:30. Tomorrow, guest artist recital by pianist Jean-Louis Hagenauer at University of Illinois, Smith Memorial Hall in Urbana tomorrow night, 7:30. U of I Tuba Euphonium Ensemble performing at the Music Building Auditorium on the Urbana campus tomorrow at 7:30. It's the Martirano Awards Concert, named for Sal Martirano, former composition faculty member at U of I, at the Krannert Center tomorrow night, 7:30. The In Your Ear Big Band are at the Iron Post in Urbana tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock. The Station Theater continues its presentation of Shakespeare's Hamlet tomorrow at 8 through Sunday. And the ISU Civic Chorale will present Handel's Messiah at the ISU Center for the Performing Arts in Normal tomorrow night at 8 o'clock. Lots of other things going on, but that's what we have time to mention. You're listening to 90.9 WYLL FM and HD Urbana with translator W293 AF Danville, NPR, classical music, and more for Central Illinois. WYLL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois. I'm Kevin Kelly. And join us again tomorrow at 4 o'clock for a live performance by a visiting group from out east. They're going to be at the Krannert Center tomorrow night. They're called the Carolina Chocolate Drops. I've been looking forward to having them on. And that'll be tomorrow's show live at 4 o'clock. For more information on the Prairie Ensemble and its concert Friday and the rest of its season, the web address is prairieensemble.org. Here's the opening of one of the pieces, well, the piece that will end the first half of Friday's concert. This is by a little-known American composer named Henry Gilbert. The piece comes from 1896. It's the opening of his suite for chamber orchestra with the American Music Ensemble of Vienna, conducted by Hobart Earle on Live and Local. Thank you.